Hell yeah.
Yeah.
I'm Liza.
I'm Riss.
And this is the Little Sleep.
Much Reading Podcast. Wow, 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 wow,
And finally, from so little sleeping and so much reading, his brain dried up and he went completely out of his mind. Favorite song.
We're silly.
We're so silly and we're so goofy, and that's it.
That's all that there is.
Do you ever put a podcast on a higher speed than it's supposed to be on Spotify?
No, but I've done that for books.
I do it for audiobooks all the time. And then the other day, I was like, can you do it on a podcast? You can do it on a podcast. And I did it on our podcast. And we sound super silly.
Do we?
Because
Do we talk really fast?
We already talk fast, I think. So when you speed us up, we sound low-key like Alvin and the Chipmunks.
Cool.
So that's kind of cunt. We're also, it's even harder to tell us apart when we're sped up. You know what I mean?
Sometimes I'm like, I want to try to talk like Liza. Like, what? How would I have to move my vocal range to match with you?
I know. Because we sound like kind of similar. But not too similar.
Mm-mm.
But it's still
would
some.
I, yeah, like, would I have to change my accent? Would I have to talk different?
Yeah, we have different accents.
I think so.
Yeah, you got Buffalo accent, I got a Connecticut accent.
Maybe they're just like American.
Yeah, I mean, I think nobody would know. Like, if you came here, I don't think anybody would say we have different accents. Because they'd be like, you're both just American. And I'd be like,
Fair.
Fair, but it's quite different. Hey, what are we doing today?
Oh, we're talking about books.
Just books.
Just any book.
Any old book.
We're actually doing our true crime video that we didn't do before.
We were meant to do this like a very long time ago. One whole season, but like early on last season, I think. It was like around like November, I think, I want to say.
I don't remember.
November. Either way. So we're going to be reading If I Did It by O.J. Simpson today.
Go Bills.
Go Bills. Can you believe O.J. Simpson died on the eve of our true crime episode? It's like it was meant to be.
It's like he knows.
We had to wait to record this episode because we needed OJ Simpson to be dead.
Did you watch The People versus OJ?
No, I didn't. Did you?
I did.
Is it really good?
It's kind of depressing.
I'm looking it up.
Misogyny was running rampant. Sarah Paulson's in it.
She is in it. He was so crazy.
Yeah.
Why? I have so many questions about that case, but like my main one is, why did he then write If I Did It? Like, what a fucking idiot.
For fun. Do you want to know the craziest thing I think OJ has done, though?
What?
He posted a video, I saw it on TikTok, where he was wearing these glasses. And I looked at them and said, those are so familiar. Those are the same exact pair of glasses my mother has. She bought that at like Walgreens or some shit.
He got Walgreens glasses?
Walgreens women's frames. Like, clearly women's frames.
I'm looking this up too because that's funny. Is it this? Is a picture with him from more recently when he got his gray hair?
I don't remember. Let me see.
I just looked up OJ Simpson glasses. If the glove doesn't fit, You must have quit. And it didn't fit. But I heard that his lawyer, I guess Mr. Kardashian, right? Told him to stop taking his arthritis medicine. And the arthritis medicine makes your hands swell. No, not taking the arthritis medicine makes your hands swell. Arthritis makes your hands swell. So that's why the glove didn't fit.
I mean, also, he was literally putting it on like this.
Yeah, he was going nuts for it.
He had like
And I saw
claw hand.
like someone else was like, I think this is a picture of him wearing the gloves, and it was from like a few years earlier, and they look very similar, but like they could just be leather gloves. But he did it. Like, there's no, he did it.
He did it.
He did it and he got away with it.
And it came. It just came down. They were focusing on the wrong issues there.
Yeah.
So.
We're not actually reading If I Did It by O.J. Simpson, everyone.
No.
What did you read?
I read Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil by John Berendt.
And I read The Burning of Bridget Cleary by Angela Bourke.
Slay girl.
When did your true crime take place?
I believe the events took place in the 80s.
1980s. Mine took place in like the 1890s.
Ooh, so we're like 100 years apart, girl. I guess that
And
means you go first.
I go first. Quickly, too, where did yours take place?
Mine took place in Savannah, Georgia.
Savannah, Georgia. Okay. And mine took place in Ireland.
Ireland.
Ireland. That's why I picked it. I guess that Morbid did an episode on Bridget Cleary somewhat recently, which I didn't know about. They did it in August 2023, which is right around the time I moved here, and therefore also right around the time I stopped keeping up with Morbid. I haven't listened in months. And I do want to talk about that too, because I want to have a conversation after both of our we talk about both of our books about like the ethics of true crime. And like, what are we, is it okay to be telling these stories in these ways? Especially when victims' families are still alive. Like, I feel a very certain type of way about that. Like, and I think the thing that's interesting, like, with my book, the author went off on a whole thing in the end and was like, you know, this story is in the public domain, and like I took certain liberties, but I tried to make it as truthful as I could given the facts. And I'm like, sometimes I think we really gotta sit back and question why we're telling the stories we're telling, especially when crime. And like, I have less of a problem again with this book because it's the case is over 100 years old. Like, nobody who was actually impacted by it is still around. But I don't know, ever since, and I took a class on women and crime fiction, and we talked a lot about like true crime. Like, I don't know, there's just certain things that have started to rub me the wrong way about the true crime community, if you will. So we can talk about that a bit later. But yeah, so this case took place in Tipperary, Ireland, in the late 1800s. That's going to be about right after the famine. So the famine would have completely decimated a lot of the rural populations in Ireland. I think the British had finally, I mean, we know, of course, they weren't ever fully removed, but they had finally taken a step back. So people had a little bit more, I guess, authority over their own lives at this point, but it's still like not great conditions for the people of Ireland, especially those not in like Dublin, and some of the other bigger cities. But yeah, it was this woman who, her name was Bridget Cleary, married to a man who was Michael Cleary, who I believe was quite a bit older than her. They didn't have any kids, and they didn't even really, prior to, pardon me, prior to when the case kind of takes place, they didn't even really live together full time. He was working in, I think, a more like populated area. So he lived there and she was sort of living on her own, and she was actually pretty cool. Like, she was like the town seamstress, very independent lady. But anyway, at the point where the case takes place, which we're talking 1894. She, sorry, 1895. She comes down with this sickness that's just like bronchitis or something. It's not really something anybody needs to worry too much about. But she's sick for like a prolonged period of time, and people in her community and then her husband are starting to be like, okay, like this is kind of weird. And so they call on a doctor. The doctor comes, he tries to cure her bronchitis or whatever it is. And Michael starts to be like, I don't think this is working. I think the doctor's medicine is never going to work on what she has, because I think she was abducted by the fairies and they put a changeling in her place. And that's who this is right now. And this whole thing unfolds where he gets a bunch of members of the community involved. And at one point, there's like 10 different people involved. And they're trying everything they can to get Bridget back, because they wholeheartedly believe that she, this is not Bridget. Bridget is off somewhere safe with the fairies, but this is like a false person. It's a trick. And they need to do something about it. And eventually, she goes missing, and everybody's like, where did Bridget go? She was sick, and then everything got weird, and now she's missing. And then a few days later, they find her burned corpse in the woods, kind of near where she lived. And this whole story unfolds that they beat her and they set her on fire. They either killed her by setting her on fire, or they beat her to death and then set her on fire. All with this idea that the fairies had taken her away and put this changeling in her place. And that if they burned this fairy creature, they could potentially get Bridget back. That's the crime aspect of it all, but it leads to this whole big trial, that I think a lot of it actually does take place in Dublin. And all the newspapers are writing about it. And a huge takeaway I had, and that I think Angela Bourke does a good job of highlighting in the book, is that the way these people, including Bridget, were treated because they were poor rural Catholics just speaks volumes about how people who were colonized have been viewed by their colonizers for centuries. They were referring to everybody who believed in sort of fairy magic as savages. They were saying they were like stupid. They were being incredibly racist, and comparing them to natives in the United States and like African tribes, and being like, these people of rural Ireland are no better than like savage African tribes, which of course is incredibly racist. And that was like the big takeaway of the case was not that this woman had been murdered, but that rural Irish people are nuts and they're uncivilized and they're uneducated and all like, and they believe in fairies and la da da da. So it kind of sucks that like a woman was dead and it needed to be investigated about what happened to her, and all anybody could do was attack poor people, and sort of exploit them in that way. Now, whether or not she was murdered because they actually believed it was fairies is unclear. So some people think that Michael Cleary was just an abusive man and he killed his wife in an act of domestic violence and burned the body. And then when people found it, covered it up by saying that he thought he was getting her back because it was a fairy changeling. I don't actually, from what I read, I don't actually think that is the case. I think they were talking about this as if it was fairies ever since the doctor's medicine wasn't working on the bronchitis or whatever. It wasn't like he came up with this whole fairy thing after she was dead, like to cover his tracks. I think he had probably some sort of psychosis. And then I think it was a case of folie à deux with the rest of the members of his community that sort of got in on it, or hysteria, almost like in the Salem witch trials. That's my like logical explanation for it. Then, of course, there's some theories that like it was actually the fairies and it was a changeling. And I'm like, yes, I think it's like, I don't want to be reductive of what these people believed at the time. Like, I wholeheartedly respect people who still like honor the traditions of fairy folklore and all that jazz. But I think you have to be careful saying that stuff because like a real human woman was murdered, was beaten and set on fire. Like, this is not just something that you can be like, well, these people actually did believe in fairies. And I'm like, yes, I totally agree. I think it was wrong that the Unionists and the English went and depicted these people as savages simply because they were rural Catholics who believed in Celtic mythology. But I think you have to look at the facts here. And what happened was a psychotic, mentally disturbed man murdered his sick wife and set her on fire. And the townspeople believed him because it was a case of just absolute mass hysteria. I think sometimes, you know, and that's not an excuse. Like, this should have never happened. She should have never died. But like sometimes you can see how these things happen low key. Like you have one person who's freaking out and being like, this is what I know to be true. Like, this is what's going on. You're gonna get other people to start believing it. And this case is really interesting because it was whatever these people were thinking, was based on fairy lore, but a lot of people go as far to say that it was the last witch burning in Ireland. And Ireland, I think, likes to say that because they also credit themselves with having, I think, the first witch burning in Europe in like the 1400s. And I'm like, well, that's a weird thing to pride yourself that they were like, here we had the first witch burning and the last witch burning. And it's like, okay. Like a lot of the time we know that the women who were burned as witches were they were independent women, they were women who weren't married, they were healers, they were maybe they were lesbians, they were outcasts. Like, so that's a weird thing. And that's the other thing too, that I wonder if people do tie parallels to Bridget and this idea of her being a witch because she was like a very independent woman. Like, she made her own money. She was married, but she was, you know, on the older side for someone who is married without children. So I think that's where people kind of draw the connection. But I think it's just a weird flex. I think focusing on the fairy aspect of it is really interesting, and sort of focusing on the Celtic folklore aspect of it, and sort of this like, you could, so many things went into it, mental illness, these people not having access to resources, because simple things had been stripped away from them for so many years because of colonization and the famine. But calling it a witch is not, a witch burning is not something that I think is should be focused on at this stage. But I thought this analysis that Angela Bourke gave was really interesting. She said, fairy belief legend provided a way of understanding congenital and other disabilities, or at least an imaginative framework which could accommodate them. Before the coming of state or religious-sponsored social services, when a large part of the population lived at a subsistence level, it also afforded a way for people driven to desperate remedies to rationalize their actions and live with the consequences. But in most cases, accounts of fairies and of people who consort with them are simply stories, fiction designed to entertain or instruct. They have beginning, middle, and end, and like many of the art forms which enrich people's lives, are structured in such a way as to leave their audiences pondering the messages they carry. And then she sort of just gets into the case a little bit more. But I think that's like a good analysis of what happened. I think there are these stories. Fairy legend were these stories that were sort of meant to teach people lessons, right? Like every fairy tale has a lesson in it, and ancient mythology is no different. But I think this idea that providing, there was, even though it was the late 1800s, people were still, you know, you couldn't really explain things with science in the way you can now. Like people were still like, something has to be wrong for my wife to still be sick, or like if a baby died or something, or if a baby had colic and wouldn't stop crying, they were like, something has to be wrong, it must be, like you can understand how it happens. And I think the part that like it particularly resonated with me was when she was like, it afforded people who were driven to desperate remedies to rationalize their actions and live with the consequences. Again, it's not an excuse. Bridget didn't need to die in this way. She didn't need to die at all. But if she had died of natural causes too, you could still argue that they would have called it her fairy changeling, and they'd have this idea that, well, Bridget's actually alive. She's off with the fairies. She's in the fairy, like maybe he make maybe Michael did think that when all was said and done. He was like, I know I burned and killed that changeling, but like Bridget is safe somewhere. Like, you know, like it's like that was reality to him. And it's just interesting how these things happen. And it's really crazy when you think about how like Folie à Deux works and hysteria works, and how other people get involved in the psychosis. But it was still like a really sad situation, nonetheless. There's this one part she writes, the funeral of Bridget Cleary, who was burned to death near Colum, County Tipperary, in the superstitious belief that she had been carried off by the fairies and an evil spirit put into possession of her body, took place at Cloven yesterday, and was boycotted by all her relations and neighbors. Not one civilian attended the burial, and the rites of sepulture were performed by four police constables. There was no hearse, and the coffin was borne by a common car from Ferthend. The significance of this will be understood when it is remembered that the Irish peasantry regard a funeral not only as an expression of respect for the deceased and of sympathy with the family, but as invested with a certain degree of sanctity. So Irish wakes are still incredibly honored to this day. They have a whole different sort of view on death over here and how to take care of your dead than we have in the United States. So I do think it was very sad that people didn't show up for Bridget Cleary and honor her in this way. That would have been, yeah, it was almost like, I don't know the word I'm looking for, but like it would have been disrespectful not to sort of have all these feudery practices for her. And so I was kind of left wondering if it was still this idea that people had in their heads that it wasn't Bridget. It was a changeling. Like they can't be having this Catholic wake for her because that's not her. She's not dead. But I think that's really sad, because obviously hindsight, we know it was her. And then here is just a little bit more of the sort of racism isn't the right word because obviously it's all white people in Ireland at the time, but like this is just a perfect example to show you how the unionists and the English who were controlling Ireland at the time talked about Catholic people and specifically rural Catholic people. A man named Michael Cleary, in a state of almost incredible grievance, superstition, and savagery, with circumstances of great cruelty, burnt his wife to death on a kitchen grate under the belief that he was exorcising an evil spirit. In this extraordinary proceeding, he was more extraordinarily assisted by several others, including the murdered woman's father. I fear the incident is indicative of a vast amount of ignorance and superstition existent still among some of the Irish peasantry. It is satisfactory to know that the perpetrators of this outrage are in hands of the law. And later, Bork goes on to highlight how they were sort of comparing, discussing that anybody who still held on to these sort of older aspects of their culture, was it like a savage likened to the Native American people, which is also just incredibly racist, of course, towards Indigenous Americans who still have these sort of remedies from the past that they try to use to help their people, because that's something they believe in. And sort of this, I don't know, it's just like this kind of, looking down on people who still hold on to their culture. And we know that the British really tried to wipe out Irish culture in its totality. Because it's not like, again, I'm not trying to make excuses, but like they were feeding Bridget like these sort of what to us today would be like bizarre remedies to try to fix her. But like you have to remember, like they thought this would work. They were like, if we feed her this milk, and like if they were giving her like a mixture of herbs and new milk, trying to like bring Bridget back. Like these are all, I don't know. I have a really difficult time with this case because I feel really bad that this happened to this poor woman, but at the same time, I feel bad for how these people were looked at as if they were like absolutely insane and evil. And I'm like, yes, there was some sort of psychosis going on with Michael Cleary, but you have to, there's so many pieces to the puzzle. And I think Angela Bourke did a decent job at piecing a really complex true crime story together. Can I say, now, in terms of a literary standpoint, like, did I really enjoy this book? Not really. I'm starting to think I don't really like this style of true crime where it is written very much like a case study. It's just not super interesting to me. But then that begs the question, should we be being entertained by true crime at all? Like when I closed this book, I was like, well, that wasn't like, I didn't have a great time reading that. It's like, I think we've reached this point as a society where we're like seeking entertainment out of these cases that were like real people who really died. And that's where I start to be like, oof, that's a little weird. It's something we need to unpack. All these true crime documentaries all these true crime TikToks, which I myself am guilty of. I'll watch every single true crime TikTok that comes up on my feed. But it's like it this sort of entertainment aspect of it is bizarre when you boil it down to what it actually is. And so I think that's what I was sort of grappling with when I sat back and finished this book and I gave it like 2 stars. I was like, oh, well, why should I have been, quote, entertained by like this horrible murder case? But I will just say this one last thing that Angela Bourke says this saying in Irish, and then she translates it at the end of the story and says, there are 2 ways of telling every story and 12 ways of singing a song. And I think that's just kind of a perfect way to encapsulate what happened with this case. And it's still a very prominent, people still talk about it here. And like I said, Morbid did it. But there have been a couple books, including fiction, adapted off of this. I think even some television series, but it's like a common sort of local myth that's actually based on a real thing that happened around here. Like they have this nursery rhyme that's like, are you a witch or are you a fairy or are you the wife of Michael Clary? And that sort of just reminds me of the what we have the equivalent in the United States would be like the Lizzie Borden took an axe, gave her mother 40 whacks. And then when all was said and done, gave her father 41. Like, and that's just something kids grow up saying. And then you look back and you're like, oh shit. Like that was like a real damn thing that occurred. But yeah, this book, I can't, like I said, I can't say that I'm like, yay, I think everybody should go read this book. It was a good book. Like, I don't think that, but it definitely gave me a lot to ponder and think about. And that's all we can ask for at the end of the day. And that's all she wrote.
No.
Hi.
That's sad.
Yeah.
I feel like I don't understand fairy lore as much as I should.
Yeah.
Like, are fairies magic?
Yeah. And they're not like nice. Like at least in Celtic, like Irish fairies aren't like good. Like you wouldn't be
Right,
like, oh.
they trick you.
Yeah, they're like scary. Like people were scared of them, or maybe still are. But I assume that's what like Victor Lavalle's The Changeling is based off of, Celtic changelings, I'm guessing. Unless it's a cross-cultural thing, which it very well might be.
I think it is. It gets a little. I think he took some liberties at the end, but it's good for
Definitely.
him.
Go for it.
I think it's really interesting that you did a true crime that was more of a case study, because I did a true crime that they call like a nonfiction novel, because it feels so much like you're reading a story. And honestly, half the stuff in here you read and you're like, no way. And I also think like John was really good at being a fly on the wall and being like almost like a non-judgmental party to all of this, which is good and bad. And I think, yeah, like also like this case is like it got to the point where I'm like, okay, why am I reading all this stuff? Like, why is it taking so long? Like, when is the true crime part gonna come? Because I'm confused on what I'm waiting for. And it definitely got to a point where I'm like, oh, he's purposely doing this so that you understand Savannah, Georgia. so that you understand that this case is so much, unfortunately, it was so much more than like someone dying. So like there are definitely times where I feel like not necessarily that he didn't give the victim as much attention as he should have, because I feel like John was genuinely writing his experience and what he saw and what people told him, and he didn't have very many experiences with Danny. And the ones he did were unfortunately pretty negative. But I think so that's where I think I had like a little bit of a problem with it, but I think for the most part, like yeah, I don't know. I think for the most part, he was just writing exactly what he experienced and leaving a lot up to readers to make their own opinions based on it. And that's pretty interesting. So let's kind of get into it. So pretty much Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil is when this John, the author, he's from New York City and he just like goes to Georgia on like a vacation or something and completely falls in love with the city. And because he's a New Yorker and he's a writer, the people there like want him around and want him to like get a glimpse of like their lives. And there's a lot of bizarre things. There's like this guy who worked for this other guy, and he would just walk his dog every day. And it was said that he would get like paid every single day that he walked the dog. And so he walks around holding like a leash that's floating in the air and like walks it around the park. And the dog has been dead for years. But he's still walking Patrick. Patrick's the dog's name. And so people like see him and they're like, still walking Patrick? And he's like, yep. Every single day he walks this dog so that he still gets paid. There's this other guy who's like, he's an inventor and he's got like horse flies that he knocks out and ties strings to and they fly around him. And he's obviously crazy and he's got a little bottle of poison and the whole town is like afraid of him because they think that one day he's just gonna go crazy and dump the poison into their water supply and kill all of Savannah. And so like when he comes into the diner in the morning, they all like watch him, and if he doesn't eat his food and leaves, they like call out to each other and they're like, he didn't eat his breakfast. Everyone, we can't drink the water for the next 2 days just in case. Like crazy friggin' stuff, okay? So the main character, there's a lot of J names in here. Wait, also I want to tell you about my favorite character. So there's this guy, his name's Joe. His name's Joe Odom, okay? He is a serial con artist. Like a crazy con artist. And he, like, you first meet him and he's having a house party in this house that isn't his, and the city shut the electric off. So he, like, somehow rigs it so that he's stealing the electricity from the people next door just so that he can continue on to have his party in the house that that's not even his, that he's just house sitting for. It's just bizarre. And, you know, there's this one point where he opened up a bar or something and had all these people do work for him and then wrote them bad checks. So all these people got together and took him to court. And like, it really wasn't like the checks didn't amount to like a lot of money, but whatever. So the judge is like reading out all the names of the people, and he gets to this one guy, which also, when Joe walks into court, he shakes all their hands And he's like slapping him up, and he's like, I'm so glad to see you. I'm so glad that you're here. All these people who are suing him. So he goes in, he slaps them all up, whatever. And then the judge is like reading out all their names, and he gets to this one guy who I think he was like an antique dealer or something, and he lived like towns over. And he was like, you didn't file your paperwork right, so like we can't do your claim. And his claim was the most money too. And Joe was like, oh, judge, you can't do that to him. Like, he drove all the way here. He lives like two towns over. And the judge is like, Joe, like, stop. Like, no, like he didn't file it correctly. And Joe was like, look, I studied law. Like, I used to be a lawyer. I'm representing myself here, but let's take like a little recess and I'll help him file his paperwork so he can still be in the case. The judge is like, you're acting against yourself. This man is filing against you. Wouldn't you assume that it would be like in your best interest to screw him up so that it would be in your favor? And Joe's like, I wouldn't do that to him. Like, I feel so bad. Like, he's from the next town over. Like, the poor guy drove all the way here. It was like a whole thing. So, the judge eventually is like, sure, man, like, you know what? Do what you gotta do. So they take a recess. He helps this man file his paperwork correctly so that he can sue him. And then he literally says, he's like, and I want the court to know on record that I'm doing this all for free. I'm not charging anything, even though my usual legal fees are. And he looks down at the bed check and is like, $1,004 or whatever it is. Just like, I just think he was my favorite character because he was so. He's a terrible guy and a con artist. He was so funny. The fact that he's a real guy and got away with this is like bizarre. So whatever, let's get into the case. So there's an antique dealer. His name's Jim Williams. And when John first meets him, he goes into the Mercer house, which is like this big famous house, and he gets a tour of it or whatever. And while he's there, this guy, this kid, he's like 21, his name's Danny. He comes in and he's like yelling and stomping around. He's clearly drunk. And he goes to Jim and he's like, I need $20. And Jim's like, for what? And he's like, I need to get messed up. I'm really mad right now. Like, my date skipped out on me. And Jim's like, you already looked messed up. Like, you're fine. And he's like, you better give me $20 right now. And they get in like an argument. And I think Danny threatens Jim or something like that. So as soon as we see Danny, he's violent and being kind of belligerent. But and it's also kind of weird that, you know, Jim Williams is like high society, in a tux, very nice things, antiques dealer, everything's clean and put together and all that fun stuff. And then he's got like Danny in his house, who's clearly like kind of trash. And so yeah, it's right off the bat, you can kind of tell that something's weird. So then our author John, he gets a call one night and is like, oh, your friend is in the paper. He shot someone. And so he looks and it's Jim Williams who shot Danny. And so then this huge like court proceeding begins, and so, yeah. So Jim Williams was tried four times for the murder of Danny. And he was guilty three out of the four times. Obviously, the last time he got off. There's a lot of things that make this case what it is. For example, Jim Williams and Danny had a relationship together, so they were gay. And you know, I think that Jim faced a lot of like, I don't think anyone in Savannah didn't know that, but I think that it still like was awkward for that to be proclaimed in a public legal space. And so there was that. Also, Jim had like a weird, he would fight with like his neighbors. They didn't like each other, and the Adlers, and the Adlers were good friends with Lawton, the DA, who was like, going against Jim. And so I think that there was also a lot of pride in this, and that they had to like get one over on Lottum. And a lot of the town didn't like him as DA because I think he did a lot of things for the black people of Savannah, Georgia. I think he was building a lot of low-income housing, and at the end of the book it mentions that he was building Victorian housing for them, and a lot of people in Georgia did not like that and weren't okay with that. And so I feel like a lot of people wanted Jim to be right so that Lawton would continue to not win a case and they could vote against him. I guess I should also describe the murder. So I guess what happened was Danny came home one night and started yelling at Jim. They argued. He like Danny broke like an antique clock or something. He like started breaking things. And Jim went into his office, and I think he went to call the police. And when he went to call the police, Danny came in and pointed a gun at him and said something like, "I'm leaving here tonight, but you're never leaving here again." And shot at him. Jim pulled out a gun from his desk and shot Billy once in the chest, and then he like flipped with the momentum of the shot and fell on the floor. And then I think he shot him once in the back, execution style or something like that. And a lot of it was fishy. The way that he was shot was fishy. It looked almost like the scene was staged. For example, like a chair that was next to Danny was on his pant leg as if it had been moved afterwards. Just like a lot of little things. At first, he got off on bail, and it just so happened that he had the bail money sitting in his house, and he called someone and told them right where it was and had them get it. Like, there was a lot of definitely fishy things to it. That made a good case against him. But also, he gets out on bond, and every year he throws this big Christmas party. And so he sent out his Christmas party invites. And the amount of people who showed up to that, knowing that like Danny died in that house and that this guy is like awaiting a murder trial, like, was insane. And while they're there, they're all talking, like the women are like joking, like, "Oh, my first husband blew his brains out with a gun like that." And, "Oh my God, that's so crazy. So did mine." Like, just very like eccentric, out of touch, rich people. I think classism was the biggest thing here. Was the biggest thing here. Even more than like the homophobia, even more than the racism, that we can get into in a minute. But I just think that that was the biggest thing. It was that Jim Williams had made himself a part of their society with his money, and nothing was going to change that. So, yeah. So, also along, this whole journey of him awaiting the trial or whatever, one night, which I think it's very interesting that our author, John, was actively associating with Jim. I think that, as a writer, as a journalistic writer, I have to give him a little bit of leniency and be like, well, he's a writer, that's what he knows to do. But at the same time, I'm like, but this guy's like a murderer. Like, and I know that like Danny wasn't the best guy either, but there were other things happening behind the scenes. Going back to this classism thing, Danny was didn't come from money, didn't have money, was raised poor, his mom kicked him out, the kid's 21, like his favorite thing in the whole world is his car. And one of the reason why a lot of people in Savannah didn't think that Jim was going to get off on this case, even though a lot of them didn't believe or didn't care if he did it or not, was because Danny was, I guess, prostituting himself. He was called, like, quote, the best piece of ass in Savannah. And not everyone had gotten a turn with him. So they thought a lot of people would be mad that Jim had killed him for that reason specifically, which is just wild. It reminds me very much of like the Capitol and the Hunger Games. It's like just bizarre. So one day, Jim and our author John go somewhere, and Jim's like, this is my best piece of defense. And he takes him to meet Minerva, who's like, I guess she does voodoo. And she was telling him, like, I've been talking to the dead, and Danny's really mad at you. And you have to make him not mad at you before we even start doing anything to the DA. So they start like doing, things to make Danny okay. And then also like putting, I don't know, is it, if it's voodoo, is it like curses or is it just black magic? I don't know. They start doing something to the DA. And Jim Williams is literally paying her like $25 a week to do this. He acts like he doesn't believe in it, but he's actively paying her this money to do it. And part of me is like, does he just need someone to really believe him? But yeah, so they try him for three times. He gets off. The fourth time, him and John are sitting in this room and they're waiting for his lawyer to get there. And he's like, John, I want to tell you something before I tell anyone else. I'm going to tell Sonny, the lawyer, today. And John's like, yeah, what is it? And he's like, I've kept my story the exact same this entire time, but I want to tell you what really happened. Everything was exactly how I said it, except for Danny shooting at me, which was a huge thing in the case because he had no gunpowder residue on his hands. They could not figure out how, if he shot the gun, where the residue went on his hands. And so he was like, look, I'm going to tell you how, like, what happened to it and where it went to. He never shot the gun because he did aim and point and pull the trigger at me. But when he did, the gun wasn't loaded. So he didn't shoot at him. So John hears this and is like, okay. And Jim's like, I'm going to tell the jury that. And John's like, but you realize if you do that, that throws away your entire case and you're admitting to perjury. Like, you're admitting that you lied to not only the judge at court, the police, but to everyone. And Jim's like, well, yes, but I think that it's going to show them that, like, he tried to kill me. Like, he still tried to kill me either way, even if it wasn't loaded. Meanwhile, his lawyer is on the way to tell him that they have just pretty much won the case because The again, the gun residue not on his hands was like a huge thing. And in the autopsy report, it says, after that, something like that happens, they bag the hand so that it touches the least amount and whatever. But the DA didn't give them the cover sheet to the autopsy report because it says right on it, that the hands were bagged after he got to the hospital because the police didn't do it. And so the nurse literally specifically wrote on there that she had bagged the hands. So that's like the winning piece in their case because it proves that the police officers didn't handle the crime scene correctly at all. And that it proves that the gun residue just could have been wiped off of his hands, and that's why it's not there. So it could have been self-defense. So then the lawyer gets there and tells him this in front of John, and John's fully knowing what Jim just told him. And John's like, or and Jim's like, "That's great. We just won the case," and doesn't say anything. So he gets off because of that. That's why he was not guilty the fourth time. And our author fully knows it. And like can't do anything about it. Like he literally went to Joe Odom, the con artist man who studied law, and was like, "Look, man, am I like, did I do something against the law? Did I do something bad by not saying anything?" And Joe was pretty much like, "Look, all of Savannah knows that Jim did it. We all know that he did it. We know that Danny didn't shoot at him. We just know it. So like you're not like by you not saying anything isn't doing anything that we all don't already know." And so this man gets off. He gets off and he goes back to live in his fancy ass house and do his fancy ass things, and no one cares, even though all of Savannah knows. And I really thought about it, and I was like, why does this book have as much stuff as it does in it? And I think that it's important to show, like, it's important to show the homophobia. It's important to show John befriends a trans woman and drag queen. Her name's Chablis, and she's like actually famous. And there's like so many people can go to her shows and laugh at her, but not treat her like a person on the street. And even like John was invited to like the black debutante ball or whatever to cover it. And Chablis's like, "Well, bring me as your guest." And he's like, "No, like these are like high society women. Like you can't come." And then he goes and she shows up anyways and is kind of a queen. And I think she like really proved a point to him. Because there's like one point where they're like, "Well, who are you here for?" And she just like makes up this random name. And they're like, "Oh my God, like we love her. She's so good, whatever." And like, I think it like makes a point. I think she's like making a point to be like, these people don't care. Like they don't care about each other. They don't care to know each other. It's just important what your image is. And I think showing like that racism plus the homophobia is so important to be like, in Savannah, what matters is your class. That's really what matters. The whole book, I was trying to figure out, like, why is he telling me all this extra stuff besides the case? It's because what matters is the class, and what matters is, who you know, and how much money you have. Not to mention, I don't know why I didn't mention this before, Jim Williams has Nazi memorabilia, shot Danny with like an antique World War II Nazi gun. And like the people know that this is how he is, and it's like funny. Like it's like, oh, he's so quirky. It's like the guy with the poison. They like think it like, oh, he's just so quirky. Just don't drink the water. And also, that guy redeems himself. I mean, he sucks and he's used the N-word and he sucks. But with the poison part, he redeems himself because he's like, I just like having it. I just like carrying it. And I think it's funny that all the people freak out about it, but no one does anything about it. Not to mention, Savannah's water reserve is so far underwater. There's no, under the ground, there's no way I can pour this bottle into it. Like, people are just stupid. I think that that's like a great way of being like, these people think that they know Savannah and they think that they know the society. They don't even know where their water comes from. So I think overall I rated this book like pretty high in my little book club book because I thought it was just a great way to like really get a good picture on a society of a place. And like maybe this is how we should be considering like portraits of a city. Like we should look at day-to-day lives of like someone who's gay, a woman, a black person, someone who's trans. Like let's look at all of their lives and let's use that to create, you know, what the society of a city actually is. Because I feel like this book really painted a great picture of what Savannah is actually like, just by showing these like little tiny instances surrounding this big case. And yeah, I think the whole thing is like terribly unfair and really just insane to think about. It's insane to just think of like Joe Odom and all the crazy stuff he does and just him getting off on that all the time. And then you have someone like murder someone and he still gets off on it. I don't know. So yeah, I feel like this book was a nonfiction southern version of The Great Gatsby. I think it was a really good book. Like I would recommend it to a lot of people. That's really what it felt like. And you know, Savannah, I hope you guys are doing better. And yeah, that's all I have to say on that.
I had no idea that the author had actually like lived the events. And that makes me have much more respect for it. I think that's very different than if he had just like learned about the case and was like, I'm gonna like turn this into a novel style book.
Right.
Like he was a fiction writer, right? Or what?
I don't know if he did like journalistic writing or if he was a fiction. I'm not positive.
He was a writer and then he just ended up living this. And so he just wrote about it. Like, that's so interesting.
And that's why I feel like I don't blame him for not like talking about Danny that much because he
Yeah.
didn't, that's not what he experienced there. And I think he continuously went back and hung out with Jim just to get the story of it all.
Right.
And I also really respect that, you know, he did get to know Jim. He was with Jim a lot. He was at Jim's house all the time, like, and he still like kept it 100 at the end.
Right.
And been like, no, this is what he told me actually happened. Like he actually killed Danny.
Right. What a
So yeah,
crazy.
I have a lot of respect for him. I think that this is a good way to do true crime.
Yes. No, and I agree. And it's interesting how. Yeah, does telling a true crime story become more ethical if the person writing about it lived it in some way? Like, that's just an interesting question. And I think it is.
And I think the part where it gets a little bit fuzzy is like there were times on trial where, you know, they interviewed, like, or not interviewed, cross-examined or whatever, some of Danny's friends who were gay, and then they had to go on trial and say that they're gay. And obviously now that's in a book.
It's
Like,
like a
there was the one
moralized
kid who
book.
he was like, I'm not gay anymore, though. Like, I experienced, but I'm not gay. And they're like, well, how long have you not been, have you not had an experience? And he was like, I don't know, like a month. And they obviously were like, oh, you've only been out of it for a month, like blah, 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 blah. And he's like, but I'm done. I'm not gay anymore. Like, the Bible says that it's wrong. But like, obviously this poor kid was like going through it. Like, he was
Right.
having some kind of inner turmoil about like the way that he felt or the things that he did. And like, for that to be immortalized forever in a book, and also to know that your best friend was murdered with
Right.
his from his gay relationship, like, that's a lot.
It's a lot. It's a lot. It's like I struggle with it. I do think, yeah. Like this style of narrative is better than some other styles of true crime where the person has really no connection to the case, but there's still like these little gaps that like that one that when you look at it, you're like, that kind of makes me feel weird.
Yeah, and I mean, I would love to assume that John got, permission and talked to people, but you never know. I'll
You know.
also say don't watch the movie.
There's a movie.
There is a movie. It came out in 97,
Oh, wow.
so very quickly. And it skips around a lot, it jumps around a lot, it doesn't explain a lot. I don't think it really does it justice, but the cool thing about it is like some of the people from the actual events are in it.
Oh,
Like,
cool.
Cheb Lee plays herself,
Oh, nice.
which is kind of slay, RIP Queen. And I think that that part of it is really cool and really good, but I don't think that it does the book any justice, really.
That's so interesting. I don't know why, but for some reason it reminds me of not the contents, but like this concept reminds me of Into Thin Air by Jon Krakauer, who is was that like adventure writer, and they invited him to write about Mount Everest, and it just so happened that he was on the expedition of the 1996 Everest disaster. And so he wrote about it. And it's like he through his experience of the events, but also like mostly highlighting other people. And it's not quite this narrative, like it's not it kind of reads like a novel, but I think that's just because Krakauer was like a pretty good writer, but like it's not meant to read like a novel like this one. But I don't know, it's just an interesting 'cause you wouldn't call it a memoir because both of these men were not telling their own stories. They were telling other people's stories, but they were there. They had a backseat view.
Right.
So it's an interesting genre, I think.
Right. And like I said, like, you never really get John's opinion on anything.
Right.
You could tell that he thinks that these people are like whacked out of their mind.
Yeah.
Like, the guy who's walking Patrick every day, you could tell he's like, what the hell's with that guy? But like, for the most part, he keeps it very neutral. He never says his feelings on Jim and like what he believes from Jim, never
Right.
says it.
Right.
So I don't know. I think he did a, I'll give him a clap.
And here's the other weird thing. I've never seen this case covered on true crime, like TikTok or anything like that.
I wonder what they would call it. Like, would they call it Danny Hansford's murder? I don't know.
Right. Because that's the other thing you have to think about. Like, if we ended up having a whole discussion about the ethics of true crime, is like, how are these things marketed? Right. And we have this conversation a lot in my class about women in crime fiction. It's true crime is still very attracted to stories where a young, white, blonde woman heterosexual Christian American gets murdered. They still very much care about that. Those are the cases that go viral. Those are the cases that get the most attention. You see it with the glorification of Gabby Petito's murder and those four kids that were killed in, where was that? By Brian Koberger just recently.
Was it Florida?
Moscow, I think it's like Idaho, Moscow, Idaho. Those
I don't
college.
know, but I know what you're talking about the college kids.
Yeah. But those were like three very traditionally pretty girls and a boy. Tragic case. But same with Gabby Petito. Tragic case. But it's like those are the things that people like get fixated on, or like JonBenet Ramsey, right? So it's like, would true crime community on TikTok even care about Danny? Probably not. Probably not. And it's like, a young man, a young indigenous man, was just murdered. They cut off, he was went missing, and then they found his body in the woods. They cut off his braids, whoever killed him, which is like the biggest horror, most horrible thing you could do, to like desecrate an indigenous person's body. And I've only seen indigenous people talking about it on TikTok.
I haven't heard about
You haven't heard of, like, I haven't, and it's just simply because I think I follow a lot of indigenous people, and then I was liking their TikToks, and then more people were coming up because of that. I
it.
haven't seen a single white person talk about it.
To be fair, I for probably like a year now have been almost actively avoiding true crime.
Yeah.
Like I'll just skip anything that comes in my For You page. I don't want to know about it. I don't want to hear about it. And I think it does have a lot to do with like it's always the same people. It's always and it's also like there's something so not real about it. Like I don't mean to say that like whatever white girl they decide to focus on who goes missing that she's not a good person, but like people are people. And like it's we can't like idolize every single person who dies and like how it is with Danny, like he wasn't great,
Right.
you know what I mean? And John says that he wasn't great, but that doesn't mean that at 21 years old he deserved to die.
Right.
And I think maybe we should talk about that too, like some people who die aren't great people and we
Right.
can't like totally idolize them, but we also should not be okay with the fact that they died.
Right. Right. Yeah. It's a weird thing. It's something that I think it's interesting too that like both of us are sitting here being like, oh shit, like I don't know how I feel about this, when we were both super into it for a long
Yeah,
time.
and like I still love more, but I still think it's fun. I just like, I don't know. I think, it's a great podcast and they make it fun. Like they
Yeah.
make it while being serious and like still taking it as seriously as they should. It's just that I don't know. There's too many things in the world to be sad about.
Yeah.
And also like as a person, I'm too paranoid enough as it is.
And that's true too. Is I think women are becoming like increasingly paranoid because of the way true crime is talked about. Like, do you ever see those TikToks of those girls being like, this is how to fortify your hotel room?
Yeah.
And I'm like, guys, like we can't be that scared. Like
I
I love,
am, though.
I know exactly. Like, take your precautions, whatever, but it's just like, it's fucked up that we have, like,
Yeah.
it's like you're altering your life because you're frightened that a man is gonna do something horrible, which he very well might do. But I also think part of it is because of how much you can't scroll five TikToks without seeing something like that, you know?
No.
So
Yeah.
it's just, it's, we're in a pickle.
We are in a pickle. The other day, actually, Nick was like, sometimes I just want us to like go out and meet new people. Like we can just like go and like talk to people when we're out. And I was like, yeah, you can do that. I can't
Can't do
do
that.
that.
Yeah.
And we had like this big conversation about it and how like I don't trust men and how the whole thing is like really scary and anxiety inducing for me, and that's just the way that I feel. And you know, Nick's is Nick, so he was totally understanding and whatever. But then the next day I was walking back to Nick's house from grocery shopping, and this man was walking in front of me, and he was kind of stumbling, and he like turned and looked back at me, and I was like, that's okay, he probably just heard me like behind him.
Yeah.
Well, he turned and looked back a second time,
Oh.
and the second time I was like, oh my God, what do I have in my bag that I can attack him with? So I had some like huge like White Claw, like the big White Claws, and I was like,
Yeah.
I'm going to take one of those and whack out of him in his brain. And he started to slow down, and then we both were like next to each other at a red light, like waiting to cross. And I hurried up and crossed the street. And then he was like, hey, the clips is today. And I could tell I thought he was a tourist because he had like an accent. And it seemed like he was kind of like struggling to speak English. So I was like, oh, he must be a tourist because like a whole bunch of people came to Buffalo for the thing.
Yeah.
And he was like, I was like, yeah, the eclipse is today. And he's like, well, what time? And I was like, I don't know. I think total eclipse is like 3:04. And he's like, well, are you gonna watch it? Like, she started asking me all these questions. So of course I freaked out, and I was freaking out, and I didn't like it. And he was like, oh, you work at 7-Eleven? Because I went to 7-Eleven to get snacks. And I was like, no, I was just grabbing snacks for the eclipse party that I'm having with all my friends and my boyfriend and tons of people. And it was really scary. And then it got to the point where like he was like, you live here? And I was like, yeah, I live in Buffalo.
What the fuck?
It was so weird. And it got to the point where like the streets like almost like V off.
Yeah.
And I knew that Nick's house was coming up. So I was like, okay, well, I can't go into Nick's house when he's like there. So I'm gonna like go around the corner. But then he was like, oh, I'm going this way. Are you going straight? And I was like, yep, I'm going straight. And he was like, okay. So he went the other way. And I was like, okay, Marissa, don't think about it. Like, it's okay. It was all in your head. It's fine. And I looked over like across the street to where he went, and he was full on staring at me while he was walking. And I
No.
was like, I'm gonna die. I'm gonna be murdered. So I like sprinted to Nick's house, unlocked the first door, locked it, ran up the stairs, locked the second door, like got all the way in. I was so scared.
Yeah. What the shit?
But that truly is the reality that we live in. And I feel
What
like a
is?
lot of times it's like, not only is it scary and you don't want to die and all that, but like, for me, it's like, I don't want to be the girl who like something bad happens and it's because I did something wrong.
Right, you start think like blaming yourself almost.
Exactly. It's like, if I'm murdered, it's going to be because I was too stupid and I got taken, or
Right. Or I was too.
I made conversation, or I was being, yeah, too nice. Like, and it's just like, it can't be like that anymore.
It, no.
I'd rather be super, super mean to
Always,
everyone I
the answer is
encounter.
to just be mean.
Yeah.
And always
Yeah.
have a mean look on your face, and then people won't even try to talk to you.
Yeah.
And
When they
that.
say good morning, don't say good morning back. Look away. Like, look at them like you're surprised that they could talk.
And then that opens a whole other can of fucking worms.
Right. Because men don't like rejection.
No.
And you could also die from
You could
that.
also
So.
get absolutely murdered for that. But. So yeah, that's nuts.
Yeah.
That's true crime for you.
That is true crime. Be safe out there.
What are we doing next week?
Next week, we're going to be doing Gothic Stories Revisited. And I'm excited because I'm going to be doing What Feasts That Night, which is the second book to What Moves the Dead.
And I'm going to be doing Where I End by Sophie White, which is another Irish book.
Slay.
I'm excited.
Me too.
It's gonna be a good episode. We'll see you guys there.
See you then. Bye.
You know, I got that thing on me.